The end of 2015 is almost upon us, and to wrap up an outstanding year of emergency medicine, we have decided to join together and make a feast out of the 2015 American Heart Association guidelines. A double helping of ACLS, a scoop of post-arrest care, maybe try to squeeze some ACS management on the edge of the plate, but like most Thanksgiving dinners, Jared, Brian, and I ended up with a plate that was more than we could manage at one time. So, we're going to take it one bite at a time and split this review into November and December with a giant culminating peer review in December to close out the year. And in the spirit of the season, if you hear, remember to take a screenshot of the article referenced. And if you hear, remember that this is the opinion of just us three turkeys. To preface this review of the American Heart guidelines that we're about to do, we have our own very strong opinions about the way things should be, especially me, in both my years of experience coming into this year as an attending. But when you listen to this, this is gonna sound a little harsh, but hopefully we can shed a little light on the evidence that's backing the guidelines, the purpose of the guidelines, and some of the thoughts that we have about the guidelines. This whole thing should really be prefaced with a turkey. Because there is a lot of opinion. There's a lot of he said, she said. There's a lot of random musings, kind of like how we start this out. So because we were splitting this in half, we wanted to end this with still a review, but not of us, thankfully, a review of the American Heart Association guidelines. So if you listen all the way to the end through half of our musings, you'll get to listen to the musings of somebody probably a little more able to muse, Dr. Peter Rosen. We asked him if he would give us a historical and personal perspective of resuscitation and the American Heart Association guidelines throughout his career. It's fascinating, and it makes our critiques look like a back rub. Did you see this prescription for, it's like a anti-opioid constipation pill of like, are you constipated from all of your opiates from chronic pain?
Like methyl naltrexone or something?
Don't stop taking your opiates.
Just don't be so constipated
by paying $800 for this super laxative.
I think it's methyl naltrexone. I think it's a oral dopamine antagonist or something like that. Or it might even be a mu antagonist.
If it's able to overcome like 60 of sustained release morphine, that thing's got to feel like a shot.
It's oral Narcan.
That'll be the next thing. It'll be an implantable instead of like Narcan for home, the auto injectors. They'll get an implantable one. You fall down, automatically releases.
Patent it right now. As soon as your oxygen dips below 70, it just gives you Narcan.
It's like an insulin pump.
Exactly.
Take some more.
Then it'll be like, how quickly can I push it to get that high before it kicks in?
Yeah.
Have you been shooting up into your Narcan pump, sir? Talking about the implantable Narcan, that is one of the new American Heart guidelines. Yes, we absolutely think that bystanders should be able to just grab Narcan and inject it in people if they see them go down. I don't know about that, man.
It's such a move, man. Can you imagine, like, oh, you look kind of down. Get some Narcan.
I can see people getting into Narcan fights, you know. Just, what happened? Well, he told me he wouldn't get me my chicken pot pie, so I stabbed him with some Narcan.
I would just like to point out that we turned you.
You turned me?
Yeah. You started off all like, oh, team, what did you call us? AJ? Team AJ's off their rocker again, and this and the other. And then by the end, you were like, yeah, I agree with them. So Aaron had to fire you from being a peer reviewer and bring you in with us.
I think you guys just improved. It's your maturity now.
I had to get some people like Casey Solomon and really put us in our place. Casey, you did a great job, by the way. We were very, very grateful for that. So anybody else that wants to help out and put Jared and I, and now Brian, in our place as well, it'd be really good. So you know, this Christmas comes twice a year sometimes. If you're doing podcasts and you're searching for stuff to talk about, having a new set of American Heart guidelines is, I mean, it's like a beautiful wrapped package with a bow. We're going to be milking this thing for the next 6 months, I think.
Yeah, you know, the interest, I was thinking about this when I was driving in today. This is probably going to be talked about on every single podcast this month. So how are we going to do this a little bit differently? And I was thinking, you know, you're pediatrics, I'm critical care, you do straight emergency medicine. So we have three different perspectives on what these new guidelines show. And I think maybe that's how we could attack it is, what does this mean to you? What does this mean to you? What does it mean to me?
Yeah. Well, the good thing, it's only three pages we had to read to get prepared for this. Yeah. It's a short guideline.
Yeah, it was very, very quick. And the updates all make sense. So that's good as well.
With high levels of evidence.
So last guidelines were in 2010, and so now in 2015 we have done a lot of work to basically say we don't like the 2010 guidelines, so we're going to improve upon them a little bit. I don't know, my reading of the majority of these guidelines were, okay, maybe you don't have to be so strict on what we said from the 2010 guidelines. If you don't want to do chest compressions first and you're pretty sure they had a respiratory arrest, go ahead and give some breaths. And, you know, push hard, push fast. Apparently, some people push really hard and really fast and can get up to, like, you know, 200 beats per minute if they wanted to with the hummingbird-style chest compression.
And you have blunt cardiac injury.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, they had an aortic rupture because of the chest compressions that we did on this 90-year-old. Somebody asked me that. They go, well, can't I push too hard on this 90-year-old? Well, 2010 guidelines would say, absolutely not. You get those chest compressions going until you hear ribs crack. Now we're like, all right, don't push too hard. So,
well, I think their verbiage, they just changed from do to if it's reasonable. Yeah. That was the 15, if it's reasonable.
What's interesting is, you know, every iteration of these guidelines, they get more vague, right? Which tells me that we just know less and less about what we're doing. For example, we just kind of assume, everyone assumes that when you do these chest compressions, you get this nice anti-grade flow, just like it would be if your heart's pumping, right? But that's probably BS. You do chest compressions, you're probably just oscillating a column of blood, both venous and arterial, back and forth, and you just hope some oxygen diffuses in there somewhere.
Yeah, you assume it's going from the heart to the brain, and then slowly going along the little subway channel and working its way back.
Right. You're probably just oscillating the same column of blood up and down in the IVC and up and down in the aorta, and you're just hoping that something diffuses.
Well, it's like the old shaker machines, right? The old day CPR, they just shake them, and maybe now, passive oxygenation, we should just go back and start shaking these people.
I will say, there's evidence that chest compressions work, that giving breaths works more than pretty much anything else in the guidelines, so there's got to be something to it, but I bet you're right. We just don't know what it is.
Right, exactly. What was the one thing that you guys were waiting for? What piece of information in the recommendations were you waiting for? Like, oh, I wonder what they're going to say about this.
The only thing that I think was really new was vasopressin being removed. They said no vasopressin. You don't need to do that anymore. And that was a change from that's been there for over 10, 15 years at least.
But what was their rationale for removing vasopressin? It just muddies the waters.
They just said it didn't, like with everything else, level 1 or 2A, with consensus opinion, that it doesn't work.
So they said that there's no evidence to support vasopressin that was actually, you know, good quality evidence. So they did say, however, that if you wanted to give vasopressin as a little cocktail along with epinephrine and methylprednisolone, then that would be reasonable if it seems to make sense to you.
Well, you know, the evidence behind the cocktail. Do you know the evidence behind the cocktail? Right, it was one study, and it was in hospital cardiac arrest. And if you look at the most of them were asystolic arrests, and they were sick patients in the hospital, so they probably have more adrenal insufficiency, so on and so forth. And so the cocktail seemed to help, but there is zero evidence on it working out of hospital. I talked to Art Sanders about it, and he said they had tried it, you know, way back in prehistoric times, and it didn't work, and that's why they haven't. Because I asked him, I said, you know, the study looked pretty good in hospital. Why haven't you guys tried it out of hospital? And he said they did try it ages ago, and it didn't work. So vasopressin being out, I thought was good. I was waiting for cooling for them to take out the therapeutic hypothermia with a lot of the repeat trials on this that showed that normothermia is just as good and if not better than hypothermia, and that you run the risk of electrolyte disturbance and dysrhythmias when you come back from cooling back into normothermia. That I was waiting for them to totally take it out. They didn't totally take it out, but they did say, well, there are probably not a whole lot of positive effects from it. So you can cool them or you can keep them normothermic. And in talking with one of the authors that we have here at the university, he said this, the pediatric version of it came out before the THAPCA trial that we covered a few months ago, that said that as long as they don't get a fever, it's probably better to keep them normothermic, aim for normal. And in talking with him, he said that probably is going to, you know, push him over for the next set of guidelines.
There were two things I was looking forward to. That was one of them. And for me, it was a little bit different because I find it interesting that these two trials on targeted temperature management come out, same issue, New England Journal, combined have a ton of patients, way more patients than the original hypothermia trial. And the initial reaction is a naysayer reaction, like, well, we don't want to change our practice on this one trial. Really, it's two trials that combined have way more patients than the original trial. But we hopped on the hypothermia bandwagon from one small trial.
Well, there's reasons we hop on these bandwagons, Jared. It's the money.
That's true.
You have to follow the money. There's devices. We have these great cooling devices.
Yeah.
The whole guidelines are based on money following.
You're, yeah, a, cons- so you're a conspiracy theorist.
I am very conspiracy.
For me, the thing I was interested in about the hypothermia, I was hoping that they said 36 for two reasons. One is what you had said about how difficult it is to manage these patients hemodynamically, electrolyte-wise, when they come out of it. But for the more important reason was prognostication. You know, if somebody comes in without a hospital cardiac arrest and they get ROSC and they're comatose, and you come in, you call me and I come down to admit the patient, I do exams, see they're brain dead. I'll be wrong a lot.
Man, you are one pathetic loser.
Yeah, I don't want to quote directly, but the last time I read this, it was around 30% of the time that if you say somebody's brain dead immediately post ROSC that's comatose, you'll be wrong 30% of the time. And so that's led to the prognostication target being 72 hours. But what's hypothermia do to that? And it really extends it because time zero starts after you've warmed them up. And so let's say you take 8 hours to get them cool, and then you keep them cool for 24 hours, and you take 12 hours to warm them up. 72 hours now becomes a week. And the whole time you're rounding on these patients every day, and you're telling the families, oh, nothing new today, nothing new today, we're not really sure, and they're in agony. So for prognostication purposes, I was looking forward to it being 36.
I was actually pretty impressed at how many different new recommendations there were regarding prognostication. They tried to find some good hard guidelines. I thought that was actually a very good push for American Heart to try to look for prognostic factors that would say this is going to be a non-survivable injury.
They've been looking for biomarkers and stuff for years, and the only thing that's really panned out is if you have like sustained or repeated myoclonic jerks at any point. That's a bad prognostic marker. The other thing I was looking forward to is what were they going to say about ECLS? ECLS is extracorporeal life support, ECMO. ECMO is kind of an outdated term because we don't use membrane oxygenators anymore, so it's really, the appropriate term is ECLS. There's a couple reasons why I was looking forward to that. One, and you know I'm kind of against it, even though that's what I do for a living, but the IOM report said, that recently came out on cardiac arrest, said, you know, this should be studied, we should look into it, because all these observational trials are showing that it might make some difference, some degree of improvement. But the improvement is really all inpatient. If you have an inpatient cardiac arrest and you can get somebody on ECMO within a short period of time, they really do better. And some of these observational trials on out-of-hospital cardiac arrest would imply that we should have all these patients go on ECMO the second they hit the ED. The problem with that is the number of patients that you see with cardiac arrest that would meet the inclusion criteria for it really is quite small. So how do you build an entire program and make sure everyone is competent in that program to put somebody on ECMO right away? I think that's quite difficult.
I know how you do that.
What's that?
You put a bunch of people on that don't qualify.
Exactly. But that's horrendously expensive. And
follow the money, Brian.
Follow the money.
Well, that brings up the other reason why I'm partially or mostly against out-of-hospital cardiac arrest going on ECMO for most cases. And that is, what's your exit strategy? We can do ECMO forever. Right, you keep somebody on forever. It's complete heart lung bypass. So what do you do when they don't have a salvageable injury and the family doesn't want to withdraw? Do you just say right up front, oh, you're going to be a donor, or we're going to withdraw care on you despite the family wanting to do that? It's going to be an ethics nightmare.
This is tough. We had one of these when I was a resident. We had a little girl who came in and she had septic shock, trashed her lungs, and ended up going on CRT and then really couldn't ventilate her, and they said, well, if we can, you know, we just need to try a little bit more, we can get her fixed. Ended up on ECMO, and her lungs were just destroyed with pneumatoceles, MSSA sepsis, and she ended up being on ECMO, extubated, eating on ECMO, and they said she needs a double lung transplant. That's the only thing we can do. And they said, we can't do that. We can't do a double lung transplant from ECMO.
By the way, on ECMO for 3.5 months.
3.5 months on ECMO. And finally, it got to the point of where we said, this is an ethics nightmare. We told the transplant surgeon, look, you go in there and watch that little girl as you unplug her circuit and say, I'm sorry, it just has never been done, and you are a contraindication to being fixed. She's mentating. She's doing schoolwork. I mean, it was impressive. And she ended up being the first, and to my knowledge, only double lung transplant off of ECMO to survive. And thankfully, I have not seen her in the ER in years.
There have been others, but my personal opinion, you know, this is what I do for a living, and I love ECMO. I think that to say, okay, ECMO looks pretty good in some of these Hail Mary cases, therefore we should be slapping everybody on ECMO, is a mistake. And I think that we need to study it. We need to realize that, you know, we have ICU survivor syndrome, and that is greatly exaggerated in patients who are coming off ECMO. They have higher bills, longer ICU stays, things like that. And I think we need to study it before we start slapping everybody on ECMO. And that's why I was really hoping, I just kept thinking, please do not recommend we start doing ECLS. So those were the two things that I was hoping that the guidelines were going to do.
So you mentioned there's some very slim criteria that you meet for going on ECMO from out of hospital cardiac arrest. What are those criteria?
Funny you should ask that, Aaron. I just got a paper accepted to critical care. It'll be coming out soon. I haven't got the proofs yet, so it might be a few weeks. But in that paper, we talk about what the optimal criteria are for ECLS for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And it's, you really should be less than 75 years old with refractory arrest or refractory cardiogenic shock after a ROSC with a witnessed VFib or VTAC arrest and a short interval to CPR initiation. To meet all those criteria, I mean, that's a very small subset of the population. Most of the patients that we have with cardiac arrest, I would argue, are older, maybe have a respiratory arrest that leads to a cardiac arrest, have multiple comorbidities, renal failure, liver failure, so on and so forth.
I mean, 75 is your cutoff. That seems older than...
Well, it's not my cutoff. It's the cutoff that's noted in the literature.
All right. You're, as a general group of ECMOtologists...
Yeah, I think the other thing I would have liked to have seen this year would have been a focus on when do we use ACLS? And they've never talked about that, right? We have all these patients found down or going into rhythms, and they talk a little bit maybe of the end of life and ethical issues, but they never get into maybe it's not a good idea to do all of this in grandma who's 85 with all her comorbidities. But maybe it's a really good idea in, you know, Mr. Smith, who's 45 and was working out in the gym and collapsed. They don't address that. they just talk about all this stuff, but they don't say who we should apply all these algorithms to. We just say, well, it's the algorithm, we got to do it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have that conversation with families when I admit somebody to the ICU, and I say, you know, CPR is really for if you and I, or if the three of us are walking down the street and I drop dead of a cardiac arrest and you do CPR on me early, the chances of me having a good outcome are pretty good. But if I've got renal failure and liver failure and respiratory failure and I'm septic and I have a cardiac arrest, the chances are not good that I'm going to have a good outcome with CPR. A person that we should talk to about this is Peter. He has very strong feelings about out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
And we plan on it. They do give a little bit of credit to that in the neonatal resuscitation, because there are, on the other extreme, patients that are born so premature that their viability is nil. So they will say, they'll make some statements of less than 500 grams or less than, I believe it's 22 weeks, that's not a viable pregnancy, and you should consider just discussing with the family. But I think, you know, so much of this is, if it's reasonable, you should consider that it would be nice to see. You should consider discussing with loved ones before initiating.
Yeah, but how are you going to do that? You know, the team's in there doing CPR, and you say, okay, every couple minutes, give some epi. I'm going to go discuss what's reasonable with the family. I mean, how are you supposed to do that? Plus, your definition of reasonable might be different than mine, might be different than yours.
That's why they use that phrasing.
Right. But I think it's even in the, as a provider doing this, when is it a time to stop? They don't mention when the time is to stop. What is your goal? Like you talked about with ECMO, you have a goal. What is my end goal here? What is my end goal of this resuscitation?
That's tough to say.
Is 5 cycles?
National guidelines.
Is 20 cycles? Is 100 cycles? And it's hard to say, but you can comment on maybe at a certain point you assess or make a reasonable decision on what the end goal is.
Sure. That's one of the things that worries me about ECLS is I can just imagine a scenario where a patient comes in and you don't get ROSC within a couple minutes, and the sexy thing to do is to drop some cannulas and put them on ECMO, and then all of a sudden you have all these non-survivable patients going on ECMO. But we all know that one patient that could make it, right? We all have that N of one of the guy who had a PE for 2.5 hours and was getting CPR and got put on ECMO and walked out of the hospital. We all know those one cases, which is why it should be studied, but not applied in general right now.
They did that on an episode of House.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the question becomes, how do you define reasonable? And I don't really know. I mean, if you think your odds of survival or what a meaningful survival means to you and whatnot, I mean, we can't get that information in the emergency department immediately when somebody comes in from out of hospital cardiac arrest. And so I think we should tend to err on the side of pushing for a while. But pushing for a while doesn't mean, oh, I'm not getting them back. They're mottled and they look terrible and they're starting to get stiff, so let's put them on ECMO.
Yeah. So let's go to some of the things they actually decided to update. So basic life support, the only thing ever shown to actually improve morbidity or mortality from an arrest, they decided that they needed to kind of revamp some of the stuff they said 5 years ago. So the things that I thought that were good, I'm glad they said, is minimize your pauses in between shocks during compressions. I mean, that goes to what we already know is if you don't push on the chest, you're going to decrease your blood pressure very quickly and take far longer to regenerate that cerebral perfusion pressure. So don't stop pushing on the chest trying to figure out, hold on, let me grab the ultrasound and see if there's cardiac activity. Don't do chest compressions. I need to intubate. Those are not the things that actually are shown to save a life. They're the things that make me as a provider feel like I have more information or that I've done something. But really, just good chest compressions and quality continuous chest compressions has been shown to have the best outcome.
Yeah, they did those studies here where they put pressure transducers in the coronary arteries of, I don't know if it was pigs or people or what, but then they do CPR on them and do a break, and they look at what the drop of the coronary perfusion pressure was and how long it took to get it back. And it's something like 30 seconds to a minute after you restart compressions that you finally get that coronary perfusion pressure brought back up. You think about that, a minute. And in another minute, you're going to give epi and then stop and do a pulse check. So you're really only getting effective chest compressions for 25 to 50% of the time.
They also said that if you have CPR without an airway, you do your 30 to 2, which is great. But if you have an airway, then just start your continuous chest compressions. If you've got a definitive airway, you can breathe through it and continue your cycle of 100 chest compressions with about 10 breaths per minute, which seems reasonable. Instead of stopping and doing 30 and then breathe through the ET tube, just keep that going. The ones that I thought were hilarious were to put the max of 120 chest compressions, which, you know, staying alive is great. Everybody knows staying alive, but 100 chest compressions and 120, it's not really all that different. I know you want recoil. I know you want to refill the heart, but I mean, most people, if you're like me, you don't have the greatest rhythm, and so being able to stay on rhythm is a little tough. It's the difference between and one hundred and one twenty beats per minute.
I don't know, man. My go-to when they bring in a cardiac arrest is while everybody else is screwing around doing the monitor and chest compression stuff, I'll slip an A-line in so that you can just monitor all this stuff invasively.
Yeah, if you watch most of the, if they're on the monitor, you can see the compressions
right.
Pretty good.
Right.
And that gives you that fake heartbeat from deflecting the monitor leads,
right.
Which then I guide and say, all right, well, you're doing 60 or you're doing 1 million. You need to slow down.
So the other one, this is probably my favorite, was to compress the chest at least 5 centimeters, but no more than 6 centimeters. I don't carry a ruler with me when I run a code, but I might have to now.
No, just take a PEDS spinal needle and just throw that 2.5-inch needle down, and you should see the tip every time they compress as it pops back out. You can also use it for your pericardiocentesis at the same time and drop the lung. You know, it's a win-win-win-win.
Right, because you can't stop compressions to do an ultrasound. So
you can't stop compressions for anything.
Can't stop. I don't know. I think the one of the best ways that I've seen to determine, you use your A-line because you can put in an A-line in an arrested patient, which I don't know how to do. But I use the pulse ox. If I can get a pulse ox waveform, even if it's 70%, I'm like, all right, we're getting some blood that's actually moving.
If it's 70%, you should probably be happy.
Oh, I'm
that's
ecstatic.
Real happy. Yeah, that's great.
We had a cardiac arrest last week that we got back. It was a respiratory to cardiac arrest, it sounded like. And the chest compressions were great. We had a good waveform. We go, all right, you're getting good compressions because I see a pulse on the waveform of the monitor. That's how I know you're doing good enough compressions. And if it's too deep, if it's actually 8 centimeters instead or 6.2 centimeters, you're getting the waveform. That's pretty good. People have come out against the automatic compressors that we used to just fit people with. And, you know, apparently that degree of like robotic standardization is not really that great compared to using humans.
Put a mechanical thumper on, a balloon pump, so that you can get to the cath lab and go on ECMO.
Right. Yeah, I'll have whoever's running the code, they should do nothing to me but other than sitting at the patient's left, right at the groin, and just put their hand on the groin, and that's my easy feedback loop. Right? Do you feel femoral pulse when someone's pushing on the chest? So now I give the feedback to my compression and saying, all right, you're getting good compressions, not good compressions, and so I have them adjust their depth, their recoil, and you can modify it that way.
Yeah, but also, just as an interesting side note, you don't really know if that's arterial or venous pulse, right? Because we talked about it. It's just an oscillating column of blood. You have no idea.
Like most of these guidelines, it's something. Right. The whole goal with this is to do something because they're dead. Right. It doesn't matter what you do. but they're dead.
What did they say about the FiO2?
So they said that when a patient is arrested, crank it up 100%. Again, I agree with Brian. I tell residents this all the time. A code is the easiest patient to take care of because they're already dead. You can't make them any more dead, and you didn't kill them. You can only help them. So they said, crank it up to 100%. And then, at least in the pediatric guidelines, they say, as soon as you get ROSC, start titrating it down.
Yeah. I know that some people are worried about the carotid blood flow with an extraglottic airway, but if you don't think that you could intubate with a video laryngoscope or DL during chest compressions, I would advocate putting one of those in and then just do 100% oxygen. The reason being, yeah, you're going to get passive insufflation of the lungs, but you're also going to get an awful lot of vomit. You know, and that's going to become a huge problem if you do get ROSC, the fact that they have profound hypoxemia from their massive aspiration episode. So I advocate for that.
Yeah, you get ROSC plus ARDS.
Right, exactly.
Then they go on that trade-off.
Right, and they also get pulmonary edema because you've just given them 6 centimeters of chest compressions at 120 minutes.
It's like a big alphabet soup of recess. So moving on to ACLS. So Jared already mentioned the FiO2 recommendation, maximal FiO2 during CPR. Just try to oxygenate them because your VQ mismatch is what's going to be causing your oxygen issue. You're not pumping blood, so you need to get as much oxygen in so that when you do push a little bit of blood around with your CPR, you get as much oxygen down as possible.
Trying to oxygenate that oscillating column.
Yeah, that makes sense. So another recommendation, end-tidal CO2 for confirming ET tube placement. We've been doing this for years now. The paramedics know it. Everybody knows. You put them on the end-tidal, and when you see that nice box waveform, you know you're in a good position versus the stomach that tends not to give you a boxy waveform. It tends to give you kind of increasing and then vomit. So if you see vomit coming through your ET tube, probably not in the right location. They also made a push for ultrasound to confirm ET tube placement. The first time I saw this, I kind of thought it was a joke, that people just were looking for stuff they could ultrasound. They were like, oh, look, yeah, you see a little double ring sign. Okay, well, that's nice. I still think we've discussed the best way to determine intubation is when you see the tube go through the cords. And now with video laryngoscopy as a, primary adjunct, which we certainly preach here, you should be able to see it go through the cords. And then if you want to confirm, I guess you can ultrasound. But, we've got, during CPR, we've got an ultrasound kind of ready for other things besides confirming your ET tube placement.
What I think would be interesting to see is a comparison or even some guidance between what's better for stopping. An end-tidal CO2, what is it, less than 20 for 10 minutes or less than 10 for 20 minutes, something like that, less than 20 for 10 minutes versus no cardiac activity on a bedside echo. It'd be interesting to see which one.
That'd be a good comparison. Because there's good, for those that present with asystole on cardiac echo, the chance of you getting that person back and surviving to any neurologic outcome is almost zero.
Right, and I think cardiac standstill should be redefined, right? I mean, you might have some epi flickers and some agonal flickers, but that does not mean that it's organized cardiac activity.
No rhythmic squeeze that you're seeing.
In which you should just keep going.
Right.
Because they probably have that if you use end-tidal CO2. You just don't see it because you're looking at the end-tidal CO2.
Yeah, we're looking for stuff that we don't know what to do with now. So we can see, we can put a little probe on and see inside the box of your heart to see what your heart's doing and, what is cardiac standstill? Is it when the valve leaflets move? Is it when the heart kind of turns a little bit counterclockwise because they're so pumped full of epi? What is it? And I think that's something that they identified as knowledge gaps. And just as a correction, it was low partial pressure of end-tidal CO2 for patients that are intubated after 20 minutes of CPR is strongly associated with failure.
Less than 10 or something like that, right?
They never go above 10.
The next one, in going with how much we love ultrasound, get your ultrasound probe away from me when I'm doing chest compressions. I think that's a paraphrase, but that's pretty much what it said. Don't let ultrasound interfere with CPR unless you're going to beat the patient over the chest to a depth of 5 centimeters with the ultrasound probe.
You should be able to do a subxiphoid view while somebody's doing chest compressions. Get your view, and then the next time you do a rhythm check, then you can see with the ultrasound.
And I think one of the mistakes that you can get into, get yourself in trouble with doing ultrasound is everybody wants to see the heart. They want to see the rhythm. They want to see what the heart's doing. And even if the heart's like flickering a little bit, do they have a pulse? I mean, it's pulse check. And then if you can see the heart, great. But get back on the chest if you don't have a pulse.
It's a double-edged sword, right? Because when we weren't using ultrasound, then it was all these people, you know, somebody was on each vessel of the extremities and the neck. And some people are like, oh, I think I feel something. I'm not sure. Why don't you see? So then we started moving to ultrasound. And then it was, let's lube up the chest with all this gel and have somebody spend a minute trying to get the view so that we can see, so that we can all see. So it's a double-edged sword.
And then our compressors are going all over the place.
Like it's a slip and slide.
Yeah. So what do you guys, how do you guys use it then? Just subxiphoid?
I do subxiphoid. And then if we actually take a break to do something, then I'll get a better view. But with subxiphoid, you should be able to see.
The only thing I run into, I use parasternal long, and I do a, the person has their hand on the groin, so someone's feeling that at the rhythm check, or at the pulse and rhythm check, they stop compression, switch up my compressor, I come on with the ultrasound probe, take a quick parasternal look while the new compressor's getting off, people are looking at the screen, they're feeling the pulse, and then we start again, and I wipe it with the cloth all at that same time. The problem I've had with subxiphoid is that you'll get, someone's been bagged, their stomach's full of air, I can't see anything, and their belly's huge,
right.
And I haven't put an OG in, and I haven't decompressed, and I'm like, gosh, I can't see anything, so then I'm jerking around with that as opposed to getting my quick look. And so for me, that's what I've gone to, is my quick, in that interruption, I do it after the first cycle, and then I don't do it again for a while.
Well, I gotta tell you, Chris Williams, one of our partners, Chris Williams, he's a very smart guy. I mean, I've said before on this podcast that I refer to you and him to keep me on planet Earth when it comes to doing emergency medicine.
Yeah, you used to be an ER doc, right?
He used to be. He does something. He started doing something. And as far as I know, he's the first person that I know of that's been doing this. He takes the linear probe and puts it on the carotid. And that's how he assesses the chest compressions, just looking at, if the whole point of CPR is to get blood to the brain, why don't you look at the blood to the brain? And then during, I think this is what he does, during rhythm checks, he'll keep it there and see if you're getting flow to the brain on its own.
Does he look for Doppler on it,
yeah,
then, and throws on Doppler,
yeah,
as well as movement?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is phenomenal. I love that idea.
Yeah.
That's really smart. And then you can slide it over the trachea to make sure that your ET tube's in place.
Now, I love that idea. I mean, I really think next cardiac arrest I have, I'm going to try that and see how it works. But if you think you're not in anyone's way, it's doing the same exact thing we were doing. We were trying to fill pulses. You're assessing what that volume is. I think it's fantastic.
Time stamp it. So this is November 2015, and that was Chris Williams' idea.
Well, I would do a cardiac view with that as your other pulse checks then. I'd still want to look at the heart. I could take out my effusion. I can take out tamponade. I can take a look at the LV function in between. But I would still, I think that's, an, you know, almost like take one look at the heart, and then the rest of the time you're on.
Right, right, right. When you're
period.
In the throes of things, just look at the carotid.
Right, just look at the carotid. I think that's a great idea.
That's really good.
So, and the last recommendations they changed, we're still doing epi for everybody, but we cut out vasopressin. Why do we cut out it, or why do we still do epi and cut out vasopressin? Because there's no evidence for vasopressin, and because there's no evidence for epi. But we've been doing it for so long.
Because epi was the first drug that was ever introduced into ACLS, and it will be the last drug that's removed from ACLS. Why? Because it's entrenched in our training for how long? I mean, this was like, remember the shock, shock, shock algorithm, big shock, mama shock, baby shock, little shock, I mean, everyone got Bertillium, and oh my gosh. So this has been around for so long. There's no evidence for it. And there's a good trial coming up. The Paramedic 2 trial is going to be coming up. And that should be there. Hopefully, that will answer the question once and for all for this.
I gotta be honest. I'm still using vasopressin. I am. Yeah, I mean, I think you want peripheral squeeze, right? And if your pH is 6.7, your epi's not going to work. But your vasopressin might.
Right, and so I'm still going to use it. I don't care what the guidelines say. I'm doing it.
So, Jared, your the evidence summary for 2015 says that the there is no benefit for survival to hospital discharge or admission, and no benefit for ROSC in using vasopressin either alone or in combination with epi.
That's great. Thank you for that advice. Duly noted. I'm still going to do it.
My N of one. Well, again, but you're also a smart guy.
What do you have to lose?
Or you have nothing to lose. You're a smart guy. These are guidelines put together for someone who doesn't know what they're doing. Right? We have to take this in our context, right? We're emergency physicians. We train for this. We do this stuff. This is for someone who's, I practice in a clinic, and I have someone that goes down, oh my gosh, I got to get my certification every 2 years, or the hospital and the clinic, and no one will love me. So that's what this stuff is for. So we're on a higher level plane. So I think you have a reason to use vasopressin, Jared, and you're doing it with a lot of background knowledge. That's totally fine. It doesn't mean that family practice doc out in the clinic should be using vasopressin on a regular basis.
Well, what I'm saying is, I mean, emergency physicians are the ones listening to this, I would assume. So what I don't want is for people to say, oh, we can't give vasopressin anymore. I mean, I think that's an incorrect interpretation. Vasopressin will cause peripheral vasoconstriction. I mean, why don't we use phenylephrine? We don't use phenylephrine because it's a partial agonist, and it just doesn't work that well. Epi is a full alpha agonist. That's why it works well. It's much more potent. That's why we use it instead of phenylephrine. But it doesn't work in extreme acidosis. Vasopressin might, because it's a different mechanism of action. You don't need catecholamine receptors for vasopressin.
So then why would the AHA take it out of their guidelines then, Jaren?
Oh, snap!
Well, the same reason why every iOS update makes it more user-friendly. You know, some people, Sage Whitmore is one of them, will say, oh, we should be using nitroprusside. Because if we're going to give all this epi, we're just going to choke off the blood supply to the brain. And my response to that is, look, if you want to get, what's the right word? If you want to get MacGyverish, my thought would be, take a bunch of nitro paste and rub it on the neck and keep using your epi and vasopressin, and you'll vasodilate the carotids and vasoconstrict everything else. But nitroprusside seems scary.
It's a lot. Yeah. Well, and people aren't familiar with the drug, so that's the hard part, too. You bring out a drug that people aren't using on a regular basis. People are pretty familiar with epidoses and vasopressin from all their courses and doing this over and over again.
Yeah, you just change the guidelines. You tell them this is what they're supposed to do. I mean, every year for pediatric advanced life support, they say, and what drug do you give? And they say, we give milrinone to the patient, a pediatric patient in congenital heart disease and heart failure. Why do you do that? Because that's what you tell me to do. What's the dose? I have no idea. It's on my pal's card. And when would you use that outside of an arrest? I have no idea. So if they took milrinone out, I'm sure there would be pediatricians and nurses everywhere rejoicing. They wouldn't have to memorize a drug they'll never use again.
It would be interesting. I'm going to put this out to Chris Williams. Rub some nitro paste on the neck and then do your linear probe with your probe.
And just put the nitro paste directly on the probe and see how well it transduces.
It might be a pretty cool experiment. It would be pretty
good. Wow. I don't know that I have ever heard so many random theoretical opinions like that before, and that's just the AHA guidelines. But I digress. The guidelines are picked apart every time they come out with them, and I agree with Brian that we have to do something. The patient's dead. We have a brief window of opportunity to try to change that. The majority of the evidence is moderate to low level, and maybe it's just expert opinion, but let's be real. Who wants to ethically sign off on a randomized controlled trial of chest compressions to no chest compressions? The one randomized controlled trial of epinephrine versus no epinephrine that they did a few years ago was underpowered by about 10%, and that in and of itself was a feat to pull off. 500 patients, even though they were powered for 5,000. It's just not easy to do high-quality evidence-based medicine on arresting patients. So though we seem to have hammered the guidelines thus far, I respect how hard it is to come up with these guidelines and have every wacko with a microphone Monday morning quarterback your hard work. I do stand by our expert consensus that the guidelines are just that, guidelines. If you follow them to the letter on every patient you have with cardiac arrest, you're unlikely to get the same outcome because no two patients are the same and we don't really know what works best. So keep giving it your best try and we'll watch the evidence progress. To give you an idea of how we got to this point and how the evidence has progressed thus far, we asked the man himself, Dr. Peter Rosen, to give us his historical perspective and his review of the resuscitation of the dead and the development of these guidelines. More to be continued next month as we talk about the remainder of the guidelines with post-arrest care and ACS with a peer review by one of our alumni. Until then, I give you Dr. Peter Rosen.
Yeah, you can tell everybody, go ahead and tell everybody, I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man, yes I am, yes I am, yes I am.
I thought I would start by giving a little history of cardiac resuscitation as it occurred in my medical lifetime, and with it, the evolution of ACLS. When I graduated medical school in 1960, the closed chest massage was just being reported by Kuvenhoven at Johns Hopkins. Prior to that, and actually subsequently to that for several years, cardiac arrest was either resuscitated with open chest massage or it was pronounced. And in fact, when I was a surgical resident running the ED 2 years later at Highland Hospital in California, we did not do closed chest resuscitation. We did open thoracotomy. And what has intrigued me over the years is that our success rate was certainly as high as with closed chest massage and maybe even a little higher. But of course, it required the patient being in the emergency department. Now, as closed chest massage evolved, which it did fairly quickly because internists don't operate, don't open chests, and they were more likely to encounter a cardiac arrest than surgeons were. A couple of other things happened. Number one, pre-hospital care was given a big boost because of cardiac resuscitation. After Vietnam, the ambulance service system in the United States had been pretty disgraceful for many decades. And one of the reasons was that it had never really evolved very much after World War II. And during World War II, most of the ambulance drivers in the country were drafted to go to war. And when they came back from war, there was no money to rehire them. So a lot of the city-county ambulance services had disappeared, which had been almost universally present at the time of from the Civil War on. So it was really not until Vietnam that there were two major impulses for improving pre-hospital care. One was trauma, and one was cardiac arrest. Cardiac arrest was particularly useful because it is the kind of thing that impresses people who watch it. It's a visible restoration of life from death. And there were any number of fire department ambulance services that had no intention of developing paramedic services until the fire chief was resuscitated from cardiac arrest and then became a big fan of it. Also, it happened at a time when the country was beginning to become aware that emergency medicine in the country was weak. But because they never really understood where patients came from, they started with pre-hospital care rather than hospital care. So no matter how much you improved the ambulance service, there was still nobody to take care of the patient when he got to the hospital. I thought that was a very big error in judgment, but that's the way it happened. Now, one of the things that happened because of that was that paramedics became a organized pre-hospital troop of technical workers, if you will. And I think because of that, people began to try to figure out protocols which they could use in the pre-hospital care system that would enable care to be rendered by non-physicians. Don't forget that coronary care units didn't really become established in this country until the late 60s, early 70s. And the first mobile coronary care units were in Belfast, Ireland, and in New York City, who were started by cardiologists who basically were going out to pick up people with chest pain to try to keep them from arresting, which was a very clever idea, because the resuscitation of cardiac arrest is dismal, was dismal then, and is still dismal now. And what's much more successful is keeping people from arresting with lipids and stents and all the things that protect the patient from the endpoint of the disease. Well, ACLS was an effort to codify a body of expert knowledge, which is one of the reasons that I despise it. I have sympathy for what the goal was, but no sympathy for the way it was carried out, because there was never a shred of evidence behind ACLS. The only evidence that we had, really, was that if you could defibrillate somebody early after arrest, then they were likely to be resuscitated. And by likely, I mean maybe 15% of the time, if that first shock worked and if they didn't recur or go into pump failure. But the overall success rate for cardiac resuscitation from the field, nobody even looked at until the guys in Washington State began to look at it and discovered that at best it was about 1% or 2%, and then they started trying to improve that by introducing ACLS to paramedics and to bystanders, CPR. And they claimed a great success for it, but if you look closely at their statistics, it wasn't a great success. One of the reasons that their survival rate looked better than anyone else's is that they never worked asystole. They just pronounced it. So that'll give you another 3 or 4% survival if you eliminate that from your population. There were a number of articles that came out of why can't we teach ACLS? Why can't we teach people how to resuscitate? And I originally wrote an editorial in 1984 in response to one of those articles. And I said the reason is because we really don't know what works. And when we don't know what works, we end up doing all kinds of things that we think are working, and therefore we're sure that we're making a difference. And I made the analogy to pigeons fed in a Skinner box. Skinner was a Harvard psychologist who was a great believer in positive and negative reinforcement of learning. And he had all kinds of animal studies where he would put animals in a box and reward them for doing some activity with a food pellet. And one series was with pigeons. And they put them in a box, and the pigeon had to peck at a button and was delivered a food pellet. Well, they fed him at random. In other words, not every time the pigeon pecked would he get a food pellet, but at random intervals they would feed him. And they discovered that the pigeons developed all kinds of wondrous behaviors. Some of them would flap their wings before they pecked. Some of them would turn around 3 times. Some of them would fly around the cage. And they were all convinced that they were controlling the distribution of the food pellet. And I said, that's ACLS. Because we invented a group of drugs that we never tested, most of which were harmful, not helpful. We invented a series of ratios between breathing and chest massage that was based on theory. And nobody ever tested the theory. Oh, they did some work in dogs, and they were quite pleased with how if they improved closed chest massage in dogs, they could have survival. Naturally, they don't know whether the dog survived with brain function. They were just talking about restoration of circulation. Same thing with epinephrine. Yes, you can produce a sinus rhythm with a shot of epinephrine, but when they studied the results of high-dose epinephrine, they discovered they had not increased survival by anything. All they had done was lengthen the time to death expensively. So while I have great sympathy for trying to organize areas of care that we don't have evidence for and that we are unlikely to acquire evidence in, I am very opposed to doctoring by committee of experts. And ACLS, in my estimation, was put together by a group of doctors who never saw a cardiac arrest and who were very good at process and who were very authoritative about how it had to be done. And we have punished thousands and decades of physicians and pre-hospital care providers and students because they didn't fit the model of the process that had been defined. I also objected to it when we finally developed the specialty of emergency medicine and we began to be the physicians who were there, who were responsible for cardiac arrest, and who knew how to do it. And yet JCO would come in and say, where's your cardiac arrest protocol? Where's your ACLS guidelines? And we don't need them. We do that. That's how we make a living. Why do we need a protocol for that? We don't have one for thoracotomy. We don't have one for anything else we do. But if you didn't have that ACLS protocol on your wall, you got a major deficit in your site visit. So that's where I am on ACLS. I have seen no improvement over the years other than periodically a new dysrhythmic drug comes along. It's very popular for a while and then is dismissed as not working any better than any other dysrhythmic drug. And we've changed a little bit from believing fervently in intubation and ventilation to believing less fervently in it. But our overall results, if you really count them accurately, are really not very good. Yeah, you can tell everybody, go ahead and tell everybody. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Yes, I am, yes, I am, yes, I am. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man.